Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What challenges and opportunities exist for the students, faculty, and staff of the largest universities in North Texas, and how are their top administrators responding? Both the University of North Texas and the University of Texas at Arlington have new presidents this year. They find themselves at the helm of these schools as they work toward achieving the rank of Tier 1 research universities and as they cope with the ongoing effort to keep education as affordable as possible for the nearly 70,000 students enrolled at their institutions combined. Neil Smotresk is president of the University of North Texas. Vistos Carbari is president of the University of Texas at Arlington. They join us today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Gentlemen, welcome to Think.
It's great being here, Chris.
Great being here, Chris.
So tell us about your explorations of the universities when you started as president and the things that you can really only learn once you're there on campus doing the job, as opposed to all the research that you did before you arrived.
That's an interesting question and always a very interesting thing for a person who comes from outside the area. Neil is at a little bit of an advantage or disadvantage, if you will. Since he came from here and returned over here after a few years. Dallas itself is it's a huge city, and the Metroplex itself is even bigger, but 7.5 million and growing. And from all the research that I've done off the university in the area, there were two things that were very, very clear. UTA was an institution that had done a lot in terms of making sure that we had access for students, that the education was excellent, and that it was a very, very innovative school. That was what you could see on paper. That's what you could see in the numbers. But when you come over here, you see this so much more. It's the seventh fastest growing university in the United States. It has 8 members in the National Academy of Inventors. It is the fifth most diverse university in the U.S. Those are things that you see only when you come here. You hear of them, but the impact of what that means to the region is something that can only be really noticed after coming over here. And the impact that a school has through the excellent students, the excellent faculty, and what it does for the region is something that is really sort of neat to see.
Well, I have a little different perspective, just having spent 22 years at my colleague's institution, UT Arlington.
And we're glad you're back.
Yeah, and those were great years, by the way. I loved them, and I have a lot of respect for UT Arlington and what happened. I went to University of Hawaii, where I had a vice chancellor role, and in that position, we directed about $450 million a year of extramural research funding. It was a major research institution, although much smaller in terms of the number of students that it had than UNLV, which was actually remarkably similar to UT Arlington, building a research identity, striving towards Tier 1, but a unique advantage in that it was the only research institution in all of Southern Nevada, which meant the focus for economic diversification and development for student training all fell on that one institution. Coming back here now and kind of sharing the experiences that I had in other institutions, the learning opportunities that I had. What I see, to make a long story short, is that there are three strong publics in this region. Each has a slightly different identity. Each has a slightly different set of strengths, but all three together can barely serve the demands of this region for higher education. We know for a fact that walking in the door here, where none of us are graduating enough students, none of us are producing just the workforce yet that we need to really continue to grow a workforce, a science and technology economy, and that we all have a challenge in terms of bringing in and helping Texas to keep the smartest kids in the state here and happy, but also making sure education's affordable. So as I walk in, what I will tell you is, three really major universities, none of those universities having quite the identity that they really need to have yet, but I think all poised to break out on a national scene, and that's what I think we're here to do.
Let's talk about graduating students, because it seems like we've done a better and better job in Texas of getting students into college, wherever that may be, and not quite as good a job of ensuring that after 4 years or maybe 5 or 6 years, they graduate with the minimum of a bachelor's degree. Where is the disconnect?
I'll start on that one. So one of the things we know is that we are gateways for first-generation populations and for very diverse populations. All of us are diverse institutions, and we're proud of that. And we see that role for us growing. But we have to remember that we're coming from families with generally low combined incomes and families that might fall in that awkward gap between being Pell eligible, where if you're earning more than about $37,000 a year, you're going to have a lot of trouble getting, you know, really good loans, and $100,000, well, if you've got two or three kids who want to go to college, boy, that's a stretch for any family and a real challenge. So to me, we need to make sure that we provide efficient and lean degree plans, and we try to contain the cost of education while still having a margin of excellence for building. So there's the business case. We pay inflationary costs for energy and services and salaries. We're in a competitive marketplace, just like everyone else is, and we can't just forego income, although there are those who would probably like us to. So when I look at the challenges for us, I would tell you I think that we need to be very strong and proactive in serving our diverse population while giving them incredibly good advice and an opportunity to develop their professional plans quickly so we can move them through. And that will help our retention efforts. That will help our graduation rates, bearing in mind that an awfully large segment of our population really does need to work and they're debt averse. So they don't really want to accumulate debt as they're going through college if they can help it. Now, that said, let's remember one final real advantage. For both of our institutions, total academic costs for a degree, if you have a lean degree, are in the ballpark of $40,000. Mm-hmm. That's about one semester at Georgetown. Mm-hmm. So I think we're doing our role in containing the costs of higher education, but we could do better, especially with giving advice and direction to students to progress at a more rapid rate.
Neil's absolutely correct, and the point that he makes is very, very powerful. Universities are doing their share, but there's so much more that we need to be able to do, and it's really reaching down to the high schools. And I don't mean down in terms of the status, but making it a continuum in terms of what the students look forward to. Some of the things that we need to do more as universities is actually connect and create those pipelines and pathways. The environment is changing. It has already changed. If you looked at us 10 years ago, academia in general, students went from high school and they went to a four-year university. Now you have students who go to community college, then go over to a four-year university, or sometimes they go back and forth. And we need to be able to prepare ourselves for that. If you look at the incoming class at UTA this year in fall, more than 58% were transfer students. And that's a very distinct population. 73% of our students actually work while they're getting a degree. And we have to keep all that in mind. We have to make sure that we have support services for the students. And that's something I'm so very proud of at UTA, that we're providing those services for our students, making sure that these diverse populations, especially those who are first generation, first to come to college, have the background that helps them make some of those important decisions in life. And that's why we send some of our counselors down to the high schools so that they can help with the FAFSA form. Those forms are very complicated.
Sure.
And if students and their parents don't understand what they can ask for or how to fill the form, we're actually putting them at a disadvantage. And I know that both our schools and a lot of others are trying to do that, increase the access by actually making sure that people are well informed of the decisions that they will have to take.
You know, there's an interesting thing that's going on over the past 4 years in higher ed, and it's really a national movement, not local, and that is as states rapidly disinvest in higher education, they're simultaneously asking for far more accountability for the dollars that they're spending. And, you know, of course, the first thing most of us in higher ed like to do is squawk about it. But the truth is we do enjoy a benefit from having state funding. What the state is now saying to us, and I think what the regions are saying, is we want to be partners with you. We want to make sure that the private sector and the public education sector have a little bit of an alignment. And that doesn't mean that we're degree mills producing for a specific category. It does mean we need to listen. And I think that's going on now. And as we listen and we learn about where there are terrific opportunities for our students, we need to be a bit more facile and help direct students into those careers so that they have a sense that there's a really great opportunity at the end of the day. Areas like IT, big data, nurturing the creative class, they're all incredibly important to us right now. And if you look at growth in our economy, it's around technical areas, IT-based areas, and entertainment broadly writ. And I mean that on a national level as well as a local level. So we need to listen. We need to be adaptive. And I think you're hearing both of us feel that's part of our mission.
That's absolutely part of our mission, and that's where urban universities such as ours have a greater responsibility to not just create an intellectual talent and create a citizenry that has been well-educated, but also create a workforce that is ready to do what is needed. If you take the example of nursing, that's a shortage across the entire nation. It's a shortage in the state of Texas. And if you look at what UT Arlington has been able to do in the area of nursing, it's been tremendous over the last 3 or 4 years as to how it's met that need. That's one example of what we as universities need to do a lot more of. It's partner with states and with the local communities, finding out what the needs are, not just of today, but what the needs are going to be for the future. Because what we have to do is prepare our students, not for the first job, but for the 7th, 8th, and 9th jobs, because they're going to change those jobs. But we've got to partner with all of us in the community, and that's what is going to take us much further.
Please correct my numbers if they are incorrect. But my understanding is that when I went off to college in the late 80s, for every dollar that a student spent at a state university, the state put in about $4 for tuition. Is that right? What is that number today?
Whoa, it's dropped way off. it's around 23% or something like that. It's quite a low number. And, of course, what that does, as the states have found very large pieces of their budget pies eaten up by, you know, mandatory funding, Medicare, Medicaid, and some of the other challenges that are out there, and as, frankly, conservative politics has eroded confidence in public education and investment, and there's a point I want to make there, we have had to place increased burden on our students. And, you know, they say you get what you pay for. Well, in public higher ed, you get much, much more than you pay for because of that extra 20%, but also because of our dedication to our mission. And I actually want to leave with a punchline I know Vishtop can agree with. If you take a look at the economic impact of a school like UT Arlington or the University of North Texas, you're going to see that it's measured at in excess of $1 billion a year on the regional economy. And that means we bring an export economy. We actually bring dollars in from out of state, and we do it pretty well. We bring in students. We bring in brains. We bring in intellectual capital. We host events. And those dollars are a vital part of our regional economies. We need legislators to stop thinking about us as a cost and think about us instead as an investment.
We're speaking this hour with Neil Smotresk, who is president of the University of North Texas, and Vistas Karbari, who is president of the University of Texas at Arlington. We're talking about the state of higher education in North Texas. If you want to join our conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Vistas Karbari, president of the University of Texas at Arlington, and Neil Smotresk, president of the University of North Texas. If you'd like to join our conversation about higher education, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Talking a little bit more about this investment in state schools, Vistas, I know that you wanted to add something to mm-hmm. the conversation and sort of what we get back for the money that we as taxpayers might indirectly invest in the university system.
That's an important point for us to look at, because when we normally talk about higher ed, what we talk about is the cost of educating a student. What we don't think of very often are the more important points that by having an institution of higher ed, especially good institutions like the ones we have over here, we're attracting industry. We're serving as an intellectual hub. We're serving as a sociocultural hub. If you think about all the companies that we're trying to attract right now to the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, one of the first questions they're going to come up with is, do you have a good university? It's not just the people who are coming in. It's also the commercialization that comes out from all the intellectual talent that is around the university, at and around the university. It's also what happens by having an institution of higher education there. So if we talk about economic benefits, that's what we should be talking about. It's not how much we invest, but what is the return on investment that we're seeing. And the return on investment is not just per student. Now, the University of Texas at Arlington graduates about 10,000 students every year. 65% of those stay in the North Texas region. And I'm sure the numbers are about the same for UNT. That in itself is a tremendous growth in terms of talent and workforce and the economy. But more than that, each of them is going to be doing something. Each of them is attracting other people to come to the Metroplex. So if you look at, let's say, Lockheed, it's a firm that has done very well in the Metroplex, and a large number of our students get jobs over there. But by having Lockheed over here, they're able to access the talent that exists at a university. They're able to use all the facilities that we have that would not be possible otherwise in terms of research and development. And by doing that, it's growing the entire Metroplex. So the benefit should not just be in terms of student numbers. It's what those students do. It's what the parents of the students do. And how many more people are being attracted over here? And what do those people do? That benefit is in the billions of dollars, and it far exceeds the investment that's being made.
There are critics of public expenditures for education who will look at things like a glittering new student center or a climbing wall in the gym or things that appear to be unrelated to academic achievement or sort of the pursuit of knowledge. Can you talk about why these things are on university campuses, and would you be at a disadvantage somehow if you were to sort of invest in bare-bones education rather than all the extras?
You know, I've had a tremendous amount of experience putting facilities up at many different institutions. I will tell you that the amenities that we put up on campus are generally backbone operations. I'll give you an example. Right now we're renovating our student union. Well, the first thing I can tell you is that without that student union, life is difficult. We're in tents and hubs and stubs and all kinds of places. The student union, when it's finished, will be a place that convenes our students, that offers them opportunities for student success centers, peer tutoring, counseling, student groups. And you might say, well, why is that even important? Well, the facts are that the more a student stays on campus, the longer the student stays on campus, the more rapid their progress will be towards graduation, the more likely they will be to succeed. In fact, those amenities not only help us on a competitive basis with other institutions, and I'd say we all have fairly similar amenities on our campuses, so there's a little bit of escalation in need. But more importantly, they create what I call a sticky campus, a campus where students are going to stay, thrive, and succeed together. And here's the final piece. You know, we talk about disruptive education and MOOCs, and we talk about online education, all of which are interesting and important. But the number one indicator of success for any student who's moving out into the job and marketplace is the ability to network. And you form networks when you meet face-to-face, both socially as well as in a business sense. And so the ability to convene and offer that and create wonderful spaces for our students to interact is utterly critical to the educational experience.
That's an important thing that we need to keep in mind. We're not just looking at education in the classroom. We're looking at the holistic educational experience that we give our students. And a lot of that occurs outside the classroom. It's that networking. It's the social interaction. It's being able to learn from each other and learn from experiences that they have on campus. We also have to keep in mind that a lot of the services that we offer are in terms of health and wellness. And if the university didn't put up facilities for that, the city would have to. So would the state. And those costs are likely to be far more expensive than they are within academic centers. So there's a great benefit in having a lot of these. And yes, we do see something come up once in a while that says, oh my gosh, you spend millions of dollars on a wall. Reality, if you look at it, is it's probably a very small part of what was being put up. There was a wall, but there were a lot of other things being done as well. Just as Neil talked about, it's counseling, it's advising, it's career development. All those other things are in that same facility. And so everyone focused on the one thing that did not seem to fit in, although it does fit in because of wellness, health, and making sure we interact.
Well, and to be fair, the vast majority of the things you're talking about, those sparkly amenities, are actually paid for by student fees. And students direct where they want those fees to go. So what they're doing is they're saying, you collect these dollars from us and please reinvest them over the long term in things that make us love our campus experience. Pretty hard to ignore that.
What is the balance at each of your schools between professors teaching undergraduate courses and teaching assistants and adjunct faculty teaching undergraduate courses?
I don't know the exact number, but at UTA, a large percentage, a majority of classes are taught by faculty. And we're very, very insistent that when we have teaching assistants, they do just that. They assist. They're there to help in large classes. They're there to make sure that students can have more sort of interactions with more experienced people. But the teaching is done by faculty. And that's so very important for us.
We have a similar workload distribution. And the truth in higher ed is that part-time faculty are extremely efficient in offering some of your classes. So there isn't a public higher ed institution nationwide that doesn't use some number of part-time faculty. But in the past few years, I will say I have personally crusaded against kind of the taking advantage of academics who haven't landed in permanent homes. I believe in creating career paths for very, very strong instructors as well as opportunities for those who have specialized interests to come in and join our campus and share something that may be unique, a career or professional perspective that really aids our students. So there's a right level of using adjunct or part-time faculty, and then there's an unhealthy level. We're very much striving to create a permanent class of high-quality instructors and tenured faculty in our classrooms. And I will say, of all the institutions I've been in, and that even includes UTA, there's more of a family feel at UNT than I have ever seen anywhere. And I think that sense of community and nurturing our students is something that is really important to creating success and to creating students who are going to go on and be supportive of their institution as alum. And I'm sure we're not the only institution that's working on that, but that community feel is really important. That comes from having a permanent cadre of faculty.
Neil's absolutely correct, and he mentioned the other point in terms of adjunct faculty. When you're situated in a metroplex such as ours, you have wonderful experts in the community. These are people who would be very, very well-positioned in a university, but often they're working for corporations or for nonprofits. They're working with museums. They're working with art facilities. We would love to have them on campus, and very often we can't afford them, very frankly, because they're very highly paid. But they come with tremendous sets of experiences, and bringing those experiences to the forefront for our students and melding the experiences that they bring with the expertise that our faculty brings gives our students a unique education. And that's something that we need to keep in mind, that when people say you're using adjuncts, let's look at the type of adjuncts that they're bringing in. If those adjuncts bring in real-world experience that is hard to see anywhere else, it's adding to the excellence of the student experience. And when you talk to our students, that's what they'll tell you, that they've been able to see the balance between the academic and the person who has worked in that field for 20 years. And that combination is what makes that education so great.
What does it take to accommodate the needs of returning students, of non-traditional students, people who may have left school for a number of years and are working full-time, often supporting families, but really want to come back and complete their degrees?
I think a lot of support and making sure that we are open to their needs. A lot of times people think about universities having just a pipeline rather than a pathway. If you look at our population, we have a large number of returning students. We have a large number of students who are working. About 73% tell us that they already have a job. We have a large percentage of our population who comes from community colleges, which means a number of them are already working somewhere and have decided to come back for an education. And in those cases, it's being open to the fact that they bring diverse experiences to the campus, and we have to take advantage of these experiences. We also have to support them and make sure that we understand that every student's going to be different. And that's one of the things that all our universities try to do so much of, not just taking it as a number, but saying that they come with a diverse experience set, they come with a different background, and therefore there is no one-size-fits-all, and we have to be able to look at that.
Well, you know, it's funny. First of all, people refer to often traditional versus non-traditional students. The non-traditional student has become the traditional student. Education has become a lifelong task. People come in, they go out, they come back in. What I see is that when you get the student who's a bit older, a bit more mature, that they know what they want, that they're highly directed, and they just expect us to make sure that we're providing timely advice in the classes they need to proceed to a goal. Very focused individuals, often quite successful, I will say, in many cases, more successful than our first-time full-time freshmen who are going through all the things freshmen go through and sorting themselves out. So I think it's a great group of folks, and all of us have wide open doors for anybody who wants to continue their education.
If you look at an example, if you take the veterans, there's a huge number of veterans in the Metroplex, and they all want to contribute, and they all are contributing. So schools like UTA have special programs to make sure that we give them the support that they want. But also we understand that they're coming in with a lot of experience that our freshmen, just as Neil mentioned, do not have. Therefore, trying to make them do everything that a freshman does is probably not appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we have to keep in mind, and we are doing. And we've been very, very successful with our veterans programs.
You've both mentioned the community college system and potential partnerships. There's been some interesting research recently that says that I guess the primary determinant of whether someone will move successfully from a community college setting to get a four-year degree at a four-year university has to do with how many of their credits transfer. Classes that they have successfully completed in the community college system in many cases don't transfer over into state universities. And I don't know the extent to which that's the case in Texas, but maybe you can address that and talk about where the disconnects exist when they do exist.
There are a couple main factors that really drive that problem, and it is a problem. But the largest problem has to do with the interaction of a set of behaviors and the specific demographic who's coming first into a university setting through a community college. They often do not have a tight degree plan. They know they ought to take a few credits. They wander, they drift, they sort themselves out. Their advising typically doesn't get them into a solid professional pathway as quickly as it should. As a result, and here's where a weird bit of psychology comes in, as a result of them being inexpensive, relatively, the price point there is less expensive, and them not being sorted, they tend to accumulate credits that wouldn't apply anywhere. And so it's not that we're, you know, the elite universities not accepting their credits. It's that they're taking a potpourri of credits that don't accelerate their progress in any specific degree pathway. The result means we need much better advising and advising support and articulation tables and career pathways for students who are in community college settings so that they don't have so many false starts.
So if I can just summarize, and stop me if I have this wrong. So a freshman level English class or freshman calculus might easily translate, but if you've taken a pottery class, that might not give you credit.
It's not just pottery.
And I don't want to be down on pottery, but
no, it's not just that. It's basically if you come to a community college and you take a wide variety of classes, and then you transfer over to a four-year university, and you want to actually major in business. A lot of the classes that you might have taken at the community college because you weren't preparing for a business degree might not apply. Mm-hmm. They might apply to some other degree, but not to that degree. And that's where the tightness of the curriculum, the need for having a lot of advising, and the need for having a career plan and articulation right from the start. So a student who comes into a community college, and the various reasons why students go, and it's a good thing for them to say, if I want to get a business degree, these are the classes that I should be taking. So at the end of my associate's degree, they will all transfer over. That can be done, but the articulation is not tight enough at this point.
Yeah, and there is one other challenge. There are both what I'm going to broadly term vocational and associate degree professional choices, as well as what you might consider early college experience choices, what that would prepare you for a four-year degree. If you're going to get a degree, and I think there's a huge need for this, and it's one that the country hasn't wrestled to the ground very well, you're going to get a degree in air conditioning maintenance, or you're going to get a degree in as an X-ray tech. Those things do not require a four-year degree. You get intense professional education in your first 2 years at a community college, and then you suddenly discover that your ability to get promotion may be truncated because you don't have that bachelor's degree. So you want to re-enter. The trouble is those highly professional classes give you very few credits in upper ed, in higher ed. So we're trying to work out paths. There's one called the Texas Two-Step I actually helped to create years ago. So let's see if we can do a little better job in streamlining those folks too.
We're talking about the state of higher education in North Texas with the president of the University of North Texas, Neil Smotresk, and Vistas Karbari, president of the University of Texas at Arlington. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the president of the University of Texas at Arlington, Vistas Karbari, and Neil Smotresk, who is president of the University of North Texas. If you'd like to join our higher ed conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. What do you think a university will look like 20 or 30 years from now that doesn't necessarily reflect exactly what's taking place today?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, we're at a cusp of a change. Some of us have made part of that change. Others are still trying to catch up. Universities grew up from a guild sort of mentality. It was basically grow, get experience in a certain field, and then move on. If you look at a university today, it is far more than just a classical education. It deals with entrepreneurship, it deals with innovation, it deals with creativity. But it also deals with a lot of cross-disciplinary work. It deals with work that is done both in the classroom and outside. If you look at the number of projects that our students run, that they run with people from outside, the engagement of the community, that's very different. So if you look at a university as it goes forward, as we look at the university, let's say, of the 21st century, it's not a university that is bound by four walls. It's a university that's actually immersed in the community and in a global environment. If you look at the advantages that we have in terms of technology, being able to bring unique instances into the classroom. For example, let's take a visit to a museum. And so one of the things that people used to do previously would be that the class would go to a museum and you'd be restricted by the type of museum that was there in the close vicinity or the timing that you could get.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually bring that in now to the classroom, allowing students to experience that. You could actually take the students out to an archaeological dig without them having to have the heat of a desert. That changes the university completely. But the other thing that changes the university completely is access. With the advent of online and distance education, used the right way, we can actually reach out to students who, for whatever reason, whether it is cost, a job, or just the fact that there are no universities close to them with that specific field, we can take knowledge to them. But that also makes it such that knowledge can come to us from everywhere in the world. Think of the best faculty across all the universities in the world being able to lecture. And we do have a number of them as guest lecturers who come in and add to it. So the university of tomorrow, if you will, is not constrained by time and place. It's something where you bring knowledge, you transform it, and it's a full experience for the student, unconstrained by walls, unconstrained by time, knowledge when you want it, and as much knowledge as you can get out of it. So it's a totally different experience.
I'm going to take a slightly more short-range and pragmatic stance on this. I don't think that the need for face-to-face education will ever really be threatened by disruptive technologies. I think it will change us. Adaptive learning technologies, the convenience of taking an online class because you couldn't get the schedule that you wanted are all drivers right now today. But how many of us have gone in to one of our student facilities and you watch, there's a table and there's like seven students sitting at the table. They're not talking anymore. They're all on their iPhones, busy texting their friends and each other. The way networking occurs is both face-to-face and virtual. So how we exploit those opportunities to enhance the learning environment, I think, is the critical question for higher education going forward. And the answer is we don't know the answer yet. The experiment's still out, but I do believe it will lead to major changes in how effective we are at delivering information and turning information into learning. The other thing that I'm interested in is more specific. You know, UT Arlington has perhaps the dominant engineering program in the North Texas region. UT Dallas has done a great job with some of its science programs. UNT is wrestling with its identity. I think as we look at an increasingly growing population, we're going to see segmentation of the marketplace. So not every school will be busy being good at all things and will increasingly begin to develop more of a flavor. And one of the things I hope that we do is that all three of our institutions develop strong national and international identities. For UNT specifically, when people say, what's going on at UNT, they think about things like the fact that we have arguably the best public music school in the country, an outstanding arts program that's producing people who are really of note on a national scale that we have. But then you blend in things like, well, a growing and creative engineering program and a logistics program over here and design and fashion and digital marketing. Well, how do those all work together and what's our flavor? Personally, I think that we have an enormously creative class at UNT that we're, I like to say we're a few degrees cooler than Austin. And we have room for people who are young entrepreneurs who have a lot of creativity who aren't quite sure where they're heading yet. We want to take that energy and direct it. It turns into many small business startups. In fact, there was an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education last week that said art degrees are good for the economy, and they are. You know, art degrees now are being used for all kinds of creative online and internet-based marketing. As you look at what we do, I would say the creative class is going to start at UNT. And that doesn't mean creativity is not an important element at UT Arlington, but we'll all have slightly different flavors. And I think how we encourage students to select us and how we encourage students to enter the career, their career pathways will be influenced by the kinds of differentiated identities that we obtain.
Well, as you look for these differentiated identities, do you think in the future that would mean universities really specialize in, say, fewer degree programs that are more intensively staffed?
I'm not sure you could say fewer degree programs that are more intensively staffed. I think you're likely to see sort of focus areas, if you will, and very broad focus areas. If you look at UT Arlington, some of the things that we've been doing very well for the past few years is health and the human condition. We have a tremendous school of nursing. We have a tremendous department of psychology, but it's also in bioengineering and in electrical engineering and computer science as we bring all that together for the benefit of health. Similarly, the things that will happen in terms of large data and data science. Mm-hmm. And if you look at those focuses, I think there will be themes that will occur from universities that draw everything around a few themes, three or four, if you will. And that's where you're likely to see the differentiation. I don't think the differentiation is going to be that we won't have a degree in history or we won't have a degree in English. Mm-hmm. It'll be that there will be a theme that comes with it.
Yeah, I think we're talking about meta-identities. And the fun part of this is that standard departmental-based degrees are of interest, but they all have to be enabled in the service of something. So it's using technologies, using big data, using informatics, using your creative outlook to help a content area achieve its full potential or vice versa. So it's not we're not living in a world where a single degree program is as germane as the opportunity to access an array of technologies and knowledge bases to achieve a broader career goal.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Orlando on the line in Richardson. Hi, Orlando.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity. Very interesting discussion. I am an endowed chair professor here in Texas, and I was the president of the Material Research Society last year. And we did a careful study on the cost of college education in the top colleges in Europe, Asia, and Latin America. And the top college in Europe, Asia, don't go more than $4,000 to $5,000 a year. I did my own education in Argentina for zero. And I wonder if you have any insight why those countries can do that, and our country here in the United States, no. And right now I have a graduate student from Mexico, fully paid by CONACYT scholarship that we don't have in NSF.
Well, there's a couple answers. One is that the state and the country in many other places make far greater investments in higher education. In fact, use them not just as drivers of the economy, but use them to drive immigration. For example, many of the northern European countries are offering free graduate education. Why? Because they're in negative population growth and their economies are suffering. We here in America enjoy the benefit of a large and growing population fueled by immigration, which is great. The job of higher education is to make sure we're bringing in those good brains and giving them access to, if it isn't H-1B visas, at least a path to citizenship. But the bottom line is that here in America, we do not make the same social investment in higher education as some of these other countries who have it as a larger and more potent part of their economic development plans. I mean, take a look at a place like Singapore, which actually uses higher education as a dominating sector of its economy. So I think the answer is that we do things a little differently here. But you can't argue with success. The American higher education system is the outstanding system in the world, period.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. I think we have time to take one more call from Pete in Arlington. Hi, Pete.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking the call.
Sure.
I really have a brief question. Many years ago, more years ago than I like to think about, when I was in college in the 60s, some of your major engineering schools around the country had co-op programs where a student would go to school a semester, work a semester, school a semester, work a semester, and the work will be related to their degree plan. Do either of those institutions represented on your program offer co-op plans?
Thanks.
Thank you.
I'll
take my answer there.
Sure.
We don't have a formal co-op program at UT Arlington, but our students do undergo co-ops. So it's not the one-on, one-off that you were describing. But one of the things that we're going to do a lot more of is have a lot of internships. And one of our goals is to make sure that every student has the possibility of going through an internship. The co-op experience, the internship experience is so very important to make sure that students do two things. One, they actually balance what they're doing at the university with something that's being done in their field of final goal or final destination. The other is it's a leg up. So when you do a co-op or you do an internship, the company that has hired you is likely to make you a job offer before you graduate. And those are things we're definitely looking at as we go forward.
What does it take to make internships more available to students who don't have significant financial resources and can't sort of work for free for a semester?
I'll start off. Vistops can follow up. But, you know, internships are remarkably hard to organize and evaluate because you're dealing with a potpourri of employers. Now, the best thing for all of us is when a single employer has a large demand and we can kind of custom adapt training and our educational programs to meet those demands. But when we're talking about 100 to 200 different employers offering anywhere from 1 to 100 positions, it's a little bit harder to organize. It takes a lot of staff. It takes also evaluation to make sure that when a student goes out, they're getting a good experience. And here's the biggest problem with internships. Again, conservative businessmen generally would think you get what you pay for, but often they want internships to be unpaid. My experience is that when you have an unpaid internship, the intern has an awfully good chance of bringing coffee to people. A paid internship, on the other hand, delivers a product because you expect a work output when you pay someone. So I'm going to say a growing regional partnership between employers and universities that offers modest but pay internships done around a central hub that could help distribute them would be one of the biggest boons to our economy that we could possibly create.
Neil's absolutely correct. It's basically integration of what the university would like our students to gain from the internship and what the corporation or nonprofit wants to gain from it. If it's basically copying articles or getting coffee, that's not an internship. What you're doing is getting a gopher. And it really comes down to that. It's that partnership between the entity outside and the university in making sure that what they're getting at the end is a highly skilled person who can jump into the workforce the moment they hire them.
Just have a few seconds left. I'll have to pick one of you. Speak briefly about what it means to be a good sort of citizen of the community as a university.
Let's do two quick answers because I think we both deserve a crack at it.
All right.
Look, listening carefully to the community, if you want to be valued, be valuable. And I think the best way to do that is for the presidents to be out and about, really hearing what the private employers, what the public sector have to say, doing thoughtful analyses, and then trying to make sure that we're helping to align those opportunities with the career paths that our students have. That, I think, helps.
Absolutely. It's one more thing, and Neil had actually talked about this earlier, which is being the intellectual and the social cultural hub for that community. We have to be off the community if we're really going to succeed.
Vistas Karbari is president of the University of Texas at Arlington. Neil Smotresk is president of the University of North Texas. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.